Accession number 28495, Reel 1.
Albert Hughes, Reel 1. Can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born in Sutton, St Helens, Lancashire.
When was that?
In the 30th of September, 1921.
What did your parents do for a living?
My father worked in the coal mines until the war. He became a trade union leader and an activist. And my mother, before she was married, did odd jobs, perhaps working on farm, but she was very busy working in the home. During the war, my father, because of his experience in trade union matters, was asked to go and become a labour officer for the Ministry of Fuel and Power. Which meant he left the mines and went into, became a civil servant with a pensionable job and an allowance to run a car, which meant he could drive around the South Lancashire coal mines with the object now of stopping strikes and difficulties in order to keep the production going. At the end of the war, he resigned from that to become the secretary of the Labour Party, and in order to become the agent for Sir Hartley Shawcross, who became our post-war MP. He wanted, of course, a safe seat, and he became the Attorney General. I've got quite a bit about my father there. He and his two older brothers joined the Territorial Army because they liked the outdoor life, which meant although they were coal miners in the reserved occupation, they went to France in 1914. The two older brothers were killed. My father survived because he happened to be on a training course on the occasion when the regiment was pretty well annihilated. He was in the 5th South Lancashire Regiment, also Prince of Wales Volunteers. All three of them won the military medal. And my father's honours after the war and later on, he got the OBE, the military medal, the Freedom of the Borough, JP, and an award for taking part in a coal mine rescue. So for a coal mine, he didn't do too bad.
That's an amazing number of awards, isn't it?
Considering that, yes. Considering his background, he was brilliant at school, and the headmaster wanted him to go to university. He felt he ought to earn money for the family, so he did that.
And what about the area you grew up in? What was that like?
The area?
Yeah.
Well, St Helens was a coal mining town, essentially, and other industries included glass, transport. It had the first canal in the country, the first railway, Liverpool to Manchester. It had a lot of engineering companies, and the chemical industry started in Lancashire at St Helens before it later on moved to Widnes. And this was possible because they had huge resources of coal. The canal, the Sankey Valley Canal, which was the first to open in the country, enabled salt and other material to come up for the chemical industry, and copper from Anglesey came up the same route up the canal for a copper industry. So in its heyday, St Helens was producing more copper than any the rest of the country put together.
Was it affected by the Depression at all?
Dreadfully, more than most areas. I remember still as a youngster the 1926 strike, mainly because the coal mines didn't go to work and they were all outside getting sunburnt. What I don't remember is that for 8 or 9 months the coal miners were locked out, not on strike, they were locked out, and they had no pay for 8 or 9 months, and they lived on charity, and the schools were kept open. Volunteers, coal miners and the wives collecting food through charity were providing 3 meals a day at the schools, and in many cases children were better fed then because they were getting decent food than they got at home. It also suffered severely from chemical industry. The first chemical industry was making washing powder, soda ash crystals, and for about every ton of soda ash they made, about a ton of hydrochloric acid was pumped into the atmosphere. So the whole area was dreadfully polluted, and there was a chronic problem with breathing difficulties and bad chests. And the doctors' waiting rooms every day were filled with people asking for their cough mixture. It was stupid to throw all this hydrochloric acid away because they were throwing money away. So eventually an Act of Parliament stopped them throwing this hydrochloric acid away and made them trap it. Once they trapped it into solution, it started a new chemistry based on chlorine and bleach. And to give you an idea of the scale of this operation, they were making, about the turn of the century, that's the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, they were producing of the order of 100,000 tonnes of soda ash a day and throwing the equivalent amount into the atmosphere of hydrochloric acid.
So the environment was quite polluted as well by today's standards?
Grossly polluted. The other byproduct at the end of this chemical process was calcium sulfide, which was deposited in huge mounds like coal waste heaps, mountains. I learned to climb on them. Now, but it wasn't calcium sulfide then. Sulfur was a valuable chemical. So a chemist worked out a way of recovering the sulfur by, his name was Chance, so it was the Chance process. So he recovered the sulfur, leaving the byproduct, crude chemical calcium hydroxide, which is crude lime. So he replaced mountains of calcium sulfide with mountains of calcium hydroxide, complete waste, until the war came. Now, when the war came, there was a shortage of lime to put on the farms. So the council saw the opportunity to sell this rubbish to the farmers at something like a shilling or sixpence a ton. So it is being transported all around South Lancashire, a big agricultural area. Farmers would like to have it, the council would like to see it go. But because it was had to be weighed, it had to go across a weighbridge. And there was a weighbridge in the town which was at the end of a line and had been used for coal as well as other things. So the man operating this weighbridge was charging something like sixpence or a shilling per weight, which is roughly the value of the load anyway. And the council officer woke up to the fact that they were not getting any rent from this man. So they went down to have a word with him about paying his arrears, which amounted to rather more than 20 years. And he said, "I'm sorry, it's mine." And it was. He had legal ownership and legal possession.
Can you tell me a little bit about your education?
I started at a very simple school, a church school, very much like our village school, with a huge one room with all the classes in it. So when you looked up, you didn't see a floor and the ceiling, you saw the rafters. And we used slates to write on, so we had to take a piece of cloth to rub it up, so we had to spit on it to rub it out. So it didn't take us long to invent the game, or rather reinvent it. Just get enough spit in one corner and see if we could get it all the way around the fastest. And we were convinced that there were lions down in the cellar.
What was the next stage for you when you
When we moved from that area, because at that time I was still living, my parents were still living in my grandparents' house because of shortage of housing. And for a short time we actually went to live with my mother's sister. Her husband was a miner, and they had a decent, comfortable mining house, so we lived with them for a year or two until we got our first council house. So then I went to Robins Lane. This was just the normal school with infants, juniors and seniors. So I started in the infants and went on to the seniors, and I failed the examination to go to grammar school, partly because I got there too late and there was a fault in my drawing instruments, two avoidable errors. And so instead I went to the roughly equivalent higher grade school in the centre of St Helens, where the head teacher, a very efficient head teacher, personally selected all the pupils he took on board. I enjoyed school and got decent marks. I was especially interested in science, mainly science, geometry, geography, things like that. It was interesting that the school leaving age then was 14, so up to the age of class age of 14, we had about 30 to 33 people in the class, and that number diminished immediately after 15, and by 15 and after 14, by 15 and a half, it had gone down to about 15. And as soon as I had passed the so-called Oxford Junior Local, which I passed with distinction, I started looking for a job. I felt I owed the money to the family. My father, in fact, helped me. Mother was most upset, but I never knew. So I left school at about 15, just past my 15th birthday, to take a job in a nearby factory making transparent paper, British Sydac. I didn't like it, and I had a problem over... I'd injured my knee, but I wasn't going to miss taking an exam. I had to take it, but I was signed unfit for work. This was known to the company because my boss was taking a similar exam on the same day. So when I went back to work, I was in trouble, and my father had to go back with me and explain the situation, and they confirmed with the factory doctor that I was genuinely not fit to work. I was fit to work as far as taking an exam, of course, but blotting my top copybook, I started looking around for another job, and I was registered with the local junior employment register, and naturally they sent me to the poison gas factory, which was about a mile from where I lived. Most interesting work, from the chemist's point of view, and remarkably healthy, because we had to be careful and work to a high standard, obviously. And having served an apprenticeship in the analytical lab to get familiar with all the different types of so-called poison gases...
How long did the apprenticeship take?
Sorry?
How long was your apprenticeship in the analytical lab?
Oh, in the analytical laboratory, about a year or so. When I say an apprenticeship, it was just a matter of chance where you placed when you went in. But this was a very good introduction to know what was going on throughout the whole factory.
Was it getting familiar with the poison gases and their characteristics?
Yes, and how to analyse them for purity and consistency, and learn how they were made. And then, having gone through this learning experience, I spent much of the later years mainly on mustard gas, making it by two different methods. The one which was preferred and used on large scale was simply to pass, I think it was acetylene, through a solution, a suspension of sulfur chloride, a sulfur monochloride, and this produced mustard gas, rather impure, but could easily be purified if necessary. Some irony there, because having become a specialist in poison gases, I remember that my father was gassed twice during World War I. Incidentally, if I thought of this, I could have had the formulas to hand, but it probably doesn't matter. The other thing we did make there during the war was DDT. I didn't work on this myself, but they produced DDT in tonnage quantities for the armed forces. The last and rather interesting and productive piece of work I did there was to produce BAL, British Anti-Lewisite. You'll find it on the internet. Lewisite contains arsenic. It's an arsenical compound. Arsenic is a heavy metal, and all heavy metals in solution can be precipitated by passing hydrogen sulfide through the solution. This is the smell of the gas, smell of rotten eggs. It's widely used in schools, and in the past, they totally ignored its toxicity. It's as toxic as hydrogen cyanide, but totally ignored. And some chemists thought out that if we could introduce a sulfur compound into the body, we can precipitate the Lewisite because of its arsenic. So they made a chemical which they called British Anti-Lewisite. If you can give me a second, I'll find the formula. We start off with allyl alcohol, and this is the formula, CH2 double bond CH, CH, OH, simple alcohol with a double bond. The purpose of the double bond is you treat it with bromine, and it goes across the double bond to make that, which is dibromopropanol. That is now treated with hydrogen sulfide to make dimercaptopropanol, which is known as British Anti-Lewisite, and that's on the internet.
And what was the main uses of it?
Well, first of all, the method of making it. This allyl alcohol was powerfully lacrimatory, and to me, I'd prefer to work with the bromine, which is potentially more dangerous. All we had to do was, those two are solutions, and we poured them into a top of a column in which was a spinner to throw them on the wall, and they'd run down this vertical glass tube, which was steam heated. That reaction would take place, and it'd be collected in a large, say, 10-litre vessel. You do it batch-wise. As soon as you put one batch through, you'd siphon, suck that out into a receiver and do the other batch. In a small, typical laboratory fume cupboard, about a metre square, this equipment would fit, and I could use about half a hundredweight of bromine a day. So over a period of a few weeks, I made a considerable amount of this. So I did all that myself. A friend did this part, in which he generated H2S by passing hydrogen through a furnace filled with heated liquid sulfur. This was put in the middle of a completely flame-proof building, all concrete and iron and so on. And that process went, I didn't stop around to watch that. It seemed to me to be too safe. As soon as I completed that, I was allowed to go into the Air Force. Its use is that it's an oily liquid with the powerful smell of hydrogen sulfide, and it makes beautiful stink bombs. I made a few to a friend after the war who worked in, shall I say, give the name, Camel Lairds. It was in the drafts, it was in the drawing office, and the drains were stinking, and they couldn't get the people to do anything about the drains. They said it's not bad enough. So I gave them a few of these, meeting in Liverpool, going to the theatre, and we threw one on the floor to test it, and it worked. And one of us got splashed, and it was him, not me, who went to the theatre stinking. But he took them to work and tried them, and they got the drains fixed.
What would the military application be?
The military application was that if you were poisoned with Lewisite, they were going to inject this into the body to circulate around the body to react with the Lewisite and cause the, because there's arsenic, it would make the arsenic insoluble. Now, it was one of these situations where the cure is just about as bad as the disease. I have no personal knowledge of it being used, but when I went back to this factory immediately after the war, because of my previous connection with it, I was asked occasionally, we'd get an order from some medical source, and we asked to send them a small quantity. We're only talking about 5 or 10 cc's, sealing glass capsules. So what I would do is I would ask someone to deliver a small quantity to me from store. I would distill it, vacuum distill it into capsules, flame seal them and post them away. And the first batch came back with a complaint: this material is contaminated with mustard gas. Now, I wasn't there when they made it. I'd left. But it didn't surprise me, because we were in a mustard gas factory. You can imagine what had happened. So we had to take extra precautions with future batches, which, and now I supervise the sampling, and I double distilled it. And we didn't get any more complaints, but we got regular orders. Because it's a general purpose antidote for any heavy metal, that means mercury, lead, cadmium, one or two more, it is potentially of value in the case of almost any heavy metal poisoning. And I believe I read about it being used in the case of severe mercury poisoning. Now, on the question of mercury poisoning, just after the war, going back into this factory, on one occasion, I and a colleague were asked to make mercury dimethyl and mercury diethyl. These are two compounds of mercury which are volatile, which makes them highly toxic. We were youngsters, not experienced, no warning. So we made these two compounds. I made the methyl, my friend made the ethyl. On mustard gas, we'd been trained to smell it. You can pick it up small quantities, and we trained ourselves. We were trained that way. So once we'd made this material, we each had a smell of our own and each other's. And the smell was not particularly noticeable. It was an elusive smell. So we tried it again. And that night, both of us had severe diarrhea all night. A good example of mercury poisoning.
Can you tell me a little bit about the properties of mustard gas? Because I know obviously you didn't work on that at that period, but you trained.
Oh, yes. It's of interest that it reacts with bodily tissues. And if liquid is allowed to get on the skin and not removed, it starts to attack and forms blisters, which take long, long time to heal. So it's important to avoid any liquid contact. Now, in addition, if it's warm enough, there's sufficient vapor pressure for it to be breathed into the lungs and start damaging lungs. And of course, it'd be very, very toxic to the eyes if it got on the eyes.
Is it attracted to moisture?
No, not particularly. It isn't soluble in water, and if there's a spillage and it goes into a water trap, like a drain, it could stay there a long time. It is of interest too in that people studying mutations made the first mutation by a chemical method by using mustard gas.
And obviously the connotations of the name mustard gas.
Some.
What does it smell of?
Oh,
is it
a sort of a sort of an almondy smell? Yes, a sort of perhaps a slight mustardy, oniony smell. It's very difficult to describe, but most characteristic. It's the kind of smell that you have to experience a few times before it is remembered. But once you've worked with it, it's certainly memorable. But if I smell it now, I wouldn't know. You know, the smell has to be constantly educated. You see, cyanide is not a particularly obvious smell. But in an exam at the technical college, one of the compounds which I had to identify was cyanide. And I may have had a slight cold, and I was boiling this up and smelling it, and I couldn't be sure. And I smelt so much of it, when I went home, I was sick, ill with cyanide poisoning.
What were the effects of that?
Cyanide poisoning. Cyanide poisoning, the cyanide reacts with the hemoglobin in the body. So the blood cannot carry oxygen because it's got cyanide on it. Now, fortunately, there is an immediate antidote. Any nitrite compound, that's something with the formula NO3 in it, will react and displace the cyanide, and the hemoglobin can then carry oxygen. There is on record an incident where a young lady lab assistant swallowed a lethal dose of cyanide, changed her mind and shouted for help, and a young chemist had the courage and knowledge to get some sodium nitrite solution and inject it into the body. He saved her life. Now, there's a much better way to do it, and I've worked with cyanide on a few occasions, both at Kodak and the Capenhurst enrichment plant. The antidote there is amyl nitrite, which is a liquid chemical, and I believe it's popular at one time in the scene, the drug and club scene. Do you know it? It's a kind of pet pill. If you breathe it, you immediately stimulate the heart. It's instant. Now, this is an advantage because if you have experienced cyanide poisoning and you break one of these capsules and smell it, immediately it's into the lungs. It's neutralising the cyanide, but it's also stimulating the heart. So when I worked at the uranium enrichment plant at Capenhurst, if we were working with cyanide, I used to have a stock of these capsules, enough to get us to the hospital comfortably. So if someone had unfortunately swallowed a significant amount of cyanide, we'd have saved their life. Now, it is interesting that hydrogen sulfide works in exactly the same way. It links onto the hemoglobin, and you can die of, if you like, chemical suffocation if you breathe too much H2S. But I don't know an antidote for that one, so I'd rather work with cyanide than this.